Yeah, you don't really. We don't even really need to use the camera because it. We want the audio.
Oh, okay. So I can take my clothes off. Good, thank you.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to the Pre-Accident Podcast. I'm your host, Todd Conklin, and you are in for a ride today. Get ready. This one is intellectually stimulating. It's also pretty darn practical in an applied sense, but you're going to hear lots of citations and quotations bantered about, and it's all good because you're going to like it. It's the podcast, and I'm so glad you're here. Are you having fun? So it's now Rocktober. We've lived through September, and we're now in Rocktober. I'm remembering my days as a disc jockey in grad school when we celebrated the great Led Zeppelin in September, and then in October we rocked out the entire time with 7 hits, no interruptions, no commercials all the time. Yeah, I used to do that. I used to have that kind of voice. Hey, everybody, Thunder Boomer's in the forecast, and it's going to be a sweet day. Get ready for a rock. But now we just talk about safety and systems and viewing the world differently. And today we're going to talk a lot about the difference between, get ready for this, between ambiguity and something else that I can't remember. Crap. And that something else is uncertainty. And I swear to God, I did not do that on purpose. Ambiguity and uncertainty. This is an interesting discussion because your initial cut on this is going to be, this is pretty semantic. We're down there in the weeds a little bit, Todd. You get us out of the weeds because we've got real people with real problems that we need to solve. In fact, I don't think it's in the weeds at all. In fact, what I think I'd share with you is that you're in a place now where uncertainty means you don't know. Ambiguity means you have to ascribe meaning. And the difference would be the sign on the door in your office someplace that says, open door slowly. That's a pretty good question, because what does slowly mean? We've talked about this before and we'll talk about it again. But until then, gosh, I don't know. It's fall. It's nice. October's nice. It's cold. It's certainly where I am. It's cold in the evenings and kind of nice during the day. And travel's getting more and more interesting, but travel's always getting more interesting. I'm not seeing you as much as I want to, so hang out more. I'm sure I'll have lots of things to tell you, big adventures in my life, lots of international travel here towards the end of the year, and that'll be fun as well. So hope all is well with you, and I hope that you can really sit back and listen to this podcast. I think you're going to find this podcast really, really good. And I know I say that a bunch, but it's because for the most part, the people that come on the podcast are really, really good. And they have lots to say, and they've thought about these problems. This is an interesting one. Dr. Van Strelen, Dave Van Strelen, is a busy guy, and he does a lot of things. But what he really did, probably first and foremost, was start the International High Reliability Conference from his side of the house. And it's a very interesting conference that went for quite a while. It's currently in sort of hiatus, but my guess is you'll see it come back. Dave is a good guy. He's completely attainable. He's a doc. He specializes mostly on the emergency side of the house, emergent medicine. But it's interesting because he, even though he talks about being a doctor, his problem solving is really more towards crews or teams of people that do high-risk work, and there's lots of us that represent those people. And so give this one a listen and enjoy what's going on. I'm sure there's going to be more news for us as we progress through. I'm sure I'll tell you all about it. But until then, why don't you sit back and listen to the podcast and see what you think. More on the backside. Have fun and enjoy.
Yeah, they're trying to bring HRO in. And so I said, you know, what this is all about, whether it's resilience engineering or normal accidents, I don't care what. It's vulnerability, and we're dealing with ambiguous information, which means that you and I can look at the same information and come to different conclusions, which means that your plans don't work.
Right, right, right. So let's actually start the podcast, because you're getting into really good crap all of a sudden.
Okay. Well, that's what I struggled with, was how do I present this to people, and I think this is working.
Well, yeah, tell me more. Tell me about that struggle and what you're finding.
My background in the 70s, I learned how to do this in high-risk situations where we could get hurt. We were in life-threatening situations. I learned it from combat vets. And I tried applying it to healthcare and it worked, but I've struggled with probably 30 years of how do I help people understand this, how learn it. Those have been in life-threatening situations understand it easily. But the other group kind of splits between those who want to rational thought. They want experimental evidence. They want proof. There's another group that understands that those who use proofs and evidence-based medicine, like it doesn't quite work in a lot of situations. So the last few months, I went back to my original work in the 90s and realized that we have vulnerability. We're working in a hostile environment. We have vulnerability. How do we respond to that vulnerability? And added to that vulnerability is the information we have, because it's early, is going to be ambiguous. It can come from different directions. It can go different directions. And I don't know how exactly I can predict its response. So I'm looking now that we're living in this hostile environment. We're vulnerable, and all of our information is ambiguous. And that differentiates from uncertainty, where if I just collect more information, my uncertainty goes away. With ambiguity, I attach meaning to it. So you and I would look at the same information and attach different meaning to that information, which means we come to different conclusions. We make sense out of it differently. And that's why I could stand in a room and not be alarmed when there's danger going on, because somebody who knows more recognizes the danger. They put meaning to those same signals that I miss. And the other way around, I can be in a room with a patient, or I can see team interactions or a physician's attitude and behaviors and beliefs and realize where that's headed. I put different meaning on it, and they put the meaning on that they're good and safe, and I put meaning into it that they're dangerous and we have conflict.
Well, now this is pretty important. Let's make a point of this, because I think this is really interesting. You're seeing a noticeable operational difference between uncertainty and ambiguity.
Yes, I am. In uncertainty, and I'm going back to Shannon's work,
sure,
on information theory and information entropy. It's certain or we don't know. It's uncertain. It's 0 to 1. And so you can digitalize it. And in uncertainty, if I collect more information, then I can remove my uncertainty.
But threat to a stable system is not uncertainty, it's ambiguity.
Well, there's a threat to the unstable system, but if I wait until I have that cascading failure and I know for a fact it's overt, decompensated state, then I can say, yeah, this is a bad spot. I still don't know what's going to work. That's the problem. But if I move backwards, and every time I see a crisis, an emergency happen, I focus on what happened before so I can learn from that. What happened? What did it look like? What was missed? How did they bypass that information? And I realized the information was there, but they put different meaning on it. And that's where I look at ambiguity, because it can have two or more. So how you came to your state where you are now, I could come up with a number of different ways you did that. And I don't know which is the truth. In reality, you could come up with a number of different ways, and you may not know exactly which one is true, because it's probably a combination. Where in your part of your career and this work you're doing now, where will you be in a year? I can see different ways it goes. How I interact and talk to you, I can't predict how you're going to respond. And that's where ambiguity comes in. I put meaning onto it. So if I say something to you and you get mad, I can put meaning on it to it that we're coming to some truth and we're getting a good discussion where we're both learning. Or I put meaning onto it that I'm out of line and I should keep my mouth shut. Or I put meaning onto it that you're overly sensitive and simply just an obnoxious jerk.
Which is true. The latter one is true.
It's true. It's not well documented. So the problem I have is that whatever I response you give to me, I can put different meanings on it. So how do I interact with that? What do I do if simply collecting more information does not clarify and remove uncertainty?
So that's a really, really good question. I mean, the question I'd ask you is that, well, first of all, does an operator know they're in an ambiguous situation or an uncertain situation? Is there some way to tell that other than just gut level feeling?
Yeah, I believe there is. And it comes, I don't want to sidetrack, but cognitive dissonance, where I'm a good person, therefore everything I do is right. That certitude you have that I'm always right. The people I find that do the best in emergencies have a bit of doubt. They're not sure. And that doubt drives them to learn more. They search for discrepancy. They look for information that I'm wrong, as well as information they're right. For example, when I go climbing when I was younger at night above timberline, you wanted to know, am I on the trail? But you don't want to walk looking down all the time because that's not safe either. So you feel the trail. And if the gravel you're walking on, the scree, feels soft on the sides, you know you're getting off the trail, and that's dangerous. So as long as you know your boundary, you can operate safely. So people who have doubt in the bad way will not act. They'll withdraw and cower and flee. They'll avoid the situation. They'll collect more data, more information. But there's another person who has that same doubt who engages in tests and probes, and they do little experiments, and that's that responsiveness.
So let me pull the string on that a bit, because that confirmation bias is super strong. So if I'm usually right, I'm going to assume I'm mostly right, which assumes I'm probably right now. And I'll go out and look for data in the environment that confirms I'm right. How do you get people to break through that confirmation bias?
Part of it is that their sense of identity. I don't want them to believe they're a good person because they're right. I want them to believe they're a good person because they figured it out. I want them to understand that, because you can't tell them that being right is dangerous, because they're going to look back. Confirmation bias feeds on itself. They'll look back at all the times they're right. In the ICU in the early days, when we had a facility that had no ICU, so they thought they had resuscitations, but they're very minor sick kids. So we opened up a real ICU with the fancy drugs and ventilators methods. And they would all come up to me and tell me what they thought the patient had and what I should do. And I realized they remember the times they were right. And I pointed out to them, you remember the time you're right. I have to remember the time I'm wrong. And that's where you see a difference between somebody who has been in a dangerous situation and got themselves out of it. Like Admiral Mercer said, once that happens, I don't want to do that again. And I realized that's a driver. And so you want to look at your failures and say, look backwards and say, what did I miss? I don't want to do that again. Versus looking at your failure, looking backwards and saying, who screwed up? I won't even go in that area again. I'll just withdraw and avoid. So you want to engage. And that's a difficult one to get, because when someone's trapped in the cognitive dissonance and the confirmation bias, and they're always looking for how they're right, if we get them early enough in their careers, we can change their attitudes. But the problem is when you promote up in an organization into the upper level of executive, a lot of times that comes with this confidence that you're always right. And that's dangerous. And if you see a leader who has doubt about himself or herself, that what they're doing is right or wrong, and trying to figure it out, we sometimes in America particularly interpret that as a weak person who doesn't know. We honor the person who knows the answers rather than we honor the person who tries to figure out the answer.
Right. In a way, what I hear you saying is that we honor the person who knows the answer, and we really probably ought to value the person that knows the question.
Exactly. And that figuring out the question of and that's probably a better way to – that is a better way to put it, not probably. So it's a better way to put it is, what's the question here? Because when – if you and I are facing a situation of ambiguity and we're making sense out of it, we may be asking the question like, did you see that? Did you see that? When really we should have been doing, did you smell that? And if you ask the wrong question, you're going to pursue and make sense out of it the wrong direction. And so you want somebody who continually reevaluates their question. Are we moving forward? Are we gaining some control here?
Wow. I like this. How often do workers, operators, doctors, emergency responders, workers, how often are they faced with ambiguity, in your opinion?
I would say, and I'm just reviewing some cases, malpractice cases where people died. And I'm working on an expert
and we're looking at it through ambiguity. And I would say that, not to sidetrack, but this is a critical part, safety and reliability, resilience comes from the mundane. How you act in the everyday is how you act in the crisis, because you expand with it. And so when I see a fever, that's actually ambiguous. When I have somebody who's in pain, that's ambiguous. And if I assume confirmation bias that it's benign, I'm not going to look any further. The joke is, again, I'm not sidetracking, but it's an important part of it. Where did you find your keys? Well, the last place I looked. Well, if I have a preset idea of what this person has, I stop looking once I find enough information to support it. I no longer look any further. And then when you think about all the stuff you found when you were looking for your keys, why don't you keep looking for your keys and find more things? So once we get to the answer, we stop looking, which means we have to reevaluate our questions. So the ambiguity is actually part of your mundane everyday. And if you follow any of these crises back, you're going to find some mundane thing where a dispatcher thought, well, this is just an excited dad. The medics are going to arrive on scene and say, well, they're just a little hysterical. And they'll miss the subtle. They'll miss that nuance. And the subtle and the nuance only comes with experience, so we want to teach it. It's a daily routine thing. And if you look at the Dreyfus brothers' work on novice, you know, beginner, novice, competent, proficient. Competency is abstract thought, abstract concepts. And proficiency, you're getting into the specific. Well, to get into the specific, I have to give anecdotal stories. I've got to tell somebody how this happened to me. We don't consider that scientific, and yet that's how you get to proficiency, and that's how you move on to expert performance. And when you listen to the stories, and I look back at my years, it's inevitably a story about something mundane that became a crisis, which made me start to focus more on the mundane, the routine, if that makes sense.
It totally makes sense. And I think what you're saying, just to sort of recap, how we perform in the mundane, when criticality expands, when catastrophe expands, when events expand, when failure expands, our capacity in the mundane expands with that failure, right?
Exactly. And that's where I differentiate between those who engage because they don't know versus those who withdraw to collect information because they don't know. So if you withdraw to collect information or you go searching for a leader, an authority for advice, you're no longer there. But when you engage, there's a lot of sensing going on that Piaget said, you know more than you can tell. And actually you, when you're engaged, you know more than you know than you can sense in the perceptual part. We used to say when we were on the ambulance work going on scene, there's just two of us, no police, no radios. When you came on scene, you became part of the problem. Not meaning that you caused problems, but your interaction changed the problem. How you walked up to a house, how you stood, the face you had, the tone of voice, the words you use changed the problem. And that's where I see that in the mundane, that's where it starts. You approach and engage the situation and the events as they evolve, and your interaction changes it. And as that changes it, it changes the way you make sense out of it, as long as we keep reevaluating our question, as you stated so well. And now we grow with the problem. And if we anticipate that this is getting a little ahead of me, I'm getting at the end of my maneuvers, why wait until I have no more things to try? So I'm thinking down the line, I've got four more things I can try, I better call for help. And some people will call for help at two things, some at six things. It doesn't matter, but you have an idea that I'm getting low on what I can do. I need to accelerate by bringing in more resources. And that way you may capture it and it'll never become a problem. Because you captured it, you engaged. So, and I've seen that in the ICU, and you see that in wildland firefighting. Yeah, it's the mundane. It's that everyday activity that captures so many things that makes it look safe that these people say, well, you know that when you watch an expert, you can't tell why they're good. Because they capture so many things that don't happen now because of it.
Oh, right. I mean, one of the things that just I think about all the time is it takes an expert to recognize an expert.
Exactly, because they see that subtlety. A buddy of mine and I in the early 70s did ski mountaineering at 10,000, 11,000 feet or more. And he started downhill skiing, which scared me because they dressed differently and the skis were different, boots were bigger, and they went on those lifts and there's a lot of people. So I got a little nervous and I said, well, how did you learn to downhill ski? And he said, well, it's easy. You take the ski lift up and don't watch the good skiers, but watch the bad skiers. You'll never know why a good skier is good, but you'll know why a bad skier is bad. Then don't do that. And I actually applied that to my life. Until I became an expert at something, I couldn't tell why somebody was good. But even a beginner can tell why a bad person is bad. And so I watched a lot of failure. So I watched how people interacted. And that's critical. I watched how they made decisions. And I said, was their decision-making faulty? Was their interactions with each other faulty? And why is that critical? We talked about how complex a jet plane is. And I was reading this article about World War II when the U.S. Army had a team of technology experts, scientists, who whenever they found some German technology, they would bring it back behind the lines. And the story was by this guy who found a jet plane. He'd never flown a jet plane. So he got in the jet plane and flew it back. And you think, well, at some point, jet planes and propeller planes have the same instrument panel because they didn't know how to make a jet plane instrument differently. So he took what he already knew and applied it and then adjusted for it. And I guess that's the problem I have with the black swan concept, because there's always something you know. There's always something you're familiar with in any event. And that's where you latch on to it, and that's where you engage, and then you expand and learn as you go. Versus the concern of a black swan is, oh, I've never seen this before. I don't know what to do. Therefore, I don't engage.
How do you teach people to think this way? I mean, what do you do to take an operator and move them into a position where they understand the power is really getting good at doing the normal, the mundane stuff? What's your secret there?
Two things. One of them, I take how I work in an emergency and I adapt that to mundane things. For example, in the hospital, nursing home, or the ICU, the paramedics, whenever you talk about a ventilator and you talk about vital signs and those constitutional signs, we put the oxygen saturation in with the heart rate and things like that. And then we put how much oxygen we're giving with the ventilator settings. And when I tested people with this, I would give them a set of ventilator settings and say, what's wrong with the patient? And they couldn't tell me. But if I gave them only the oxygen saturation and only the amount of supplemental oxygen, they immediately drove them to act. And I said, so I have people present in a way of, here's what I did, here's what I saw. It's an adaptation of John Boyd's OODA loop. Don't tell me what you think is happening. Don't tell me what you want to do. But tell me what you did and what happened, because now you've generated information. And that's pretty much critical to that aspect of how do you do the mundane. The other one is to make them make decisions. And this came across when I thought we could do it with a lot of cognitive basis. The competency base, let's do the abstract, let's get them up to a competency and know what they're doing, maybe in a rule-based system like Rasmussen said. And I spent a lot of time with a nursing group so that they could transport children without a physician present, critically ill children from other hospital. A one-week course, 40 hours, plus they rode along with doctors. They actually ran a call, transports, with the physician watching. So I had a couple of cases of kids that the paramedics were going to take from the local ED to our ward. I thought that would be a good one to practice on. Next thing I know, I'm getting called up that why are you doing this to the paramedics? I mean, the nurses. Why are you so hard on them? And I didn't know what she's talking about, so I go in to meet with the VP, and she's telling me that I'm stressing the nurses, and I could understand why. Then I realized they had to make decisions without anybody there to second guess or advise them. So I went out to my buddies who worked fire, paramedic, been in military combat, and I asked them, is the very first decision you ever made? And except for one or two people who said they always made good decisions, everybody said the first decision they made where they weren't second-guessed, where they weren't checked on, made them sick to their stomach. They were nervous. I asked respiratory care people, the first time you gave an inhalation medicine as needed, did you feel sick to your stomach? And they all said yes, even though it was a benign thing. If you're wrong, it's no big deal. So I realized the first decision you make is kind of like first light. the Big Bang, the first decision you make is very painful and upsetting. So no matter how minor. So in the ICU on rounds, I would have the staff always make a decision. They had to make the final decision. And that told me who was willing to make a decision. And if they made the wrong decision, I would give them more information until they made the decision that I wanted. And then I stopped giving them information. That also told me where their knowledge gaps were in real time. And I know my wife now, we worked together before we were interested in each other romantically or anyway. And a few years ago, she said, you know, I always wondered about you. And I go, why? She says, well, it's kind of like fly away. I says, you look like an imposter doctor because you never knew anything. Every time you had a patient on rounds, you'd always go, what do you think? What should we do? Just like the guy in the movie Fly Away, he would do that. And I thought you just were probably not the smartest doctor we had in the hospital. And then when she heard my story, she realized what I was doing was I was making them make the decision. At some point, it doesn't matter if you use 10 milligrams or 15 milligrams. It doesn't matter if you do 3 hours or 4 hours. But I want them to make that decision. And that's probably the most critical thing of paying attention, of sense-making, of that feedback loop, the responsiveness. You have to make a decision and observe the outcome and then adapt your decision to that observation.
In the normal, right? I mean, what I hear you saying is that you must practice these reliability disciplines in normal, mundane work in order to be able to call on those during times of need.
See, then it's just an expansion. All you're doing is you're taking what you normally do and you're good at and just expanding it a little bit. And you don't even know at that point it's an emergency. If you consider this as an emergency, you run a great risk of falling into the amygdala, the fight, flight, or freeze response, the fight showing up as anger, frustration, and coning of your attention, the flight response showing up as avoidance, blaming other people. And the freeze response showing up as the cortisol mediated, where you just can't think of what to do and you can't even recall the protocol. How do you stay out of that? Well, if it's a routine operation for you, it's far less danger to become influenced by the fear responses.
How do you lead this?
Well, as I said, there's a couple of groups. The group that I've worked with who have been in live or die situations routinely, they take away from this, and they reinforce me that I'm on the right path, is that this gives them the science that explains what they do. Up until that time, there was just a pragmatic approach with no science. And so you can say it's not scientific, but there's science supporting it. But they'll use it because it makes perfect sense to them. So most of this has been taught word of mouth, one-to-one, and it spreads throughout an organization. The group that is the obstructionist in that sense, and which finds offense with this, are the ones who either they're rationalist, kind of like Descartes. They want to think it through, and they believe that they could think through the answer if they just have the information and time. They'll think through this. The other group in there is empirical. Now, the pragmatic people are empirical in the sense of Francis Bacon, of you want to see what works in the environment with feedback. But these empirical people are the ones who are more of the experimental, like Fisher in the 20s, of let's design an experiment. And the problem I encounter there is, in order to design an experiment, these are what I call the experimental empiricists, you have to control only one element. And then you do your experiment and see what happens. Everything has to be random and independent. And so I end up with this world of evidence-based medicine where I have, if I know the situation, I know what to do, and I know my outcome. Duncan Dearley, in an article in the 70s, wrote and called that the trivial problem. But that's where your evidence-based medicine are people who want facts, and facts will guarantee your hypothesis, that deductive reasoning. They're very confident in it because they proved it. The problem with that is that in our world, the statistics, the probabilities are not additive like they do for a normal distribution. They multiply each other, and that's the power distribution, what some people call the Pareto curve or the Paretic distribution, and which means that if I have a percent chance of this happening and a percent chance of that happening in a normal distribution with a random and independent, I simply add those probabilities. And I have my outliers I can ignore because they rarely happen. But a person who looks at them as how they multiply with each other, now you're multiplying your probabilities, things can happen, and the outlier becomes a rare event, but it's a sign of what can happen. And it's a sign that if it happened once, it can happen again, but worse. And that's where reliability and resilience is. Those people look at any event that's an outlier and say, I have to pay attention to that because it is either a process, it's the beginning of a process, or they look at it and say, if this happened once, it can happen again.
What do you think? That is David Van Stralen. He is an interesting cat, to be sure. If you took nothing else out of this conversation today, I want you to listen to the idea of expanding capacity. If the capacity exists in the mundane, then when the abnormal happens, the capacity to handle the abnormal expands with the event. That, my friends, is something to ponder. In fact, I kind of wonder if that's exactly what we do when we manage safety and reliable systems. If that is, in fact, safety differently. The ability to have expanding capacity to manage off-normal conditions. Wow. What do you think? I'm going to have Dave back on for sure. He has so much to say, and it was a very interesting conversation. I hope you liked it. Hey, thank you for listening. Do something fun every single day, and for goodness sakes, be safe. Expanding capacity.